You know, we spent too much of this week talking about the everyday, the mundane, environment policies, transfer payments, taxes, highways, all very important. But I want to get back to some broad strokes. I want to talk tonight about Canadian heroism, both present and past. And we saw real Canadian heroism last week at the Francophonie Summit. There was a resolution that was proposed by Egypt that would have extended the concern of the summit for the Lebanese civilian victims of the Middle East war, without mentioning the Israeli victims. And our prime minister said no. Not only said no, walked out of the final press conference until it was resolved. And it was finally resolved into a balanced declaration. It was a remarkable thing. We threw our weight around, and we won. And you know why that's important? Because all the other stuff, the environment policy and taxes and highways, that's all important. But that's bookkeeping. That's not vision. And that's not national character. Where a country goes is very much defined by the direction that its leader takes it in its role in the world. And after years, particularly the past dozen years of salon liberals and chattering classes and telling us that we're a middle power, we need to be nuanced, we need to be balanced, Stephen Harper has shown us that we can play with the big boys. And for perhaps the first time in a generation, there's a political will that is breathing life into those words in our national anthem that we are the true North, strong and free. We're true to what is right. We're strong in our resolve. We will be free of the chains of moral relativism and political equivalency. This prime minister seems to be taking us to a new rendezvous with destiny. And if we don't keep it, we may just condemn this country to eternal irrelevance, mired in horrible moral turpitude. And he's got a great team with him. And one member of that team is our first guest tonight, and he's a dear friend, Senator Consiglio Danino. And we're going to be talking about another issue, because this isn't the first time this prime minister has brought this country to moral purpose. He did it with the election of the Hamas government. He did it when he said in Kandahar, Canadians don't cut and run. He did it when he called the only Western leader for the arrest of Zayed Mortazawi, the Iranian prosecutor that killed Zahra Kazemi, the Montreal photojournalist. He did it with a United Nations address that was perhaps the most eloquent and courageous of any Canadian prime minister in my memory. And he did it on an issue that we're going to talk to Senator Danino about, when, contrary to recent governments, on two occasions where the Dalai Lama came to Canada and they decided that they weren't going to recognize the visit officially because, God forbid, we should upset that wonderful free state nation, China, who we subsidize with half of our tax dollars, he gave recognition to a man universally acclaimed as a symbol of peace. And Senator Danino wrote, in response to some chattering class liberals who were concerned of what this would do to China, he said, well, if that gang finds recognition given to a man who embraces values of peace and justice worrisome, then the old gang is out of step with most Canadians. And I agree. Senator Consiglio Danino, welcome. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
How you doing, Barrow? Listen, I got to correct you on one thing.
Tell me.
You said we can play with the big boys. I disagree with you. We are.
We are a big boys.
Attaboy. And I haven't seen this kind of principled position, particularly at the Francophonie. I haven't seen this since Brian Mulroney took on the world on apartheid. Do you remember those many, many years ago?
Yep.
We've had a bunch of wishy-washy prime ministers since then who've always been afraid to stand up and stand up for what's right and stand up for justice and values.
We now have
a prime minister who's got the, as you know in the Italian word, the coglions. And I may get criticized.
See,
for that.
You don't get criticized. You could say anything like on the air. My deal is you could say anything except the F word.
Well, I don't use the F word.
Okay. Then we're fine.
But I think that that this is something that we should not only cherish, we should actually be promoting it. We now have, finally have some leadership that has been missing in this country for 15 years.
Senator, we're just going to pay a bill before I get whacked here, and we're going to come right back, and I want to talk to you about something that we called on previous governments to promote, and it didn't happen until this prime minister came into office. We'll be right back.
Now, the new 940 Montreal presents The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman.
Good evening, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. You know, we're going to get right into the show tonight for logistical reasons, but also because I'm kind of excited about this story. Usually, and we talk about politics and what is going to happen with this convention and that convention, and you've heard the yapping of the politicians all day long and the little petty sniveling. Who do we want to head up this commission to check up on that bridge? You know what? Sometimes we Canadians get it right. Kind of like our Prime Minister did at the Francophonie last year. We stand up for something and we get it right and the world pays attention. We'll be talking about that tomorrow night. But right now, I want to talk about a remarkable Canadian heroine and a remarkable Canadian success story. And we've had her on before, and I'm literally catching her at the airport, and she was kind enough to give us a few moments. Nazanin Afsanjan, as many of you remember, was Miss World Canada. She was first runner-up. Earlier this year, she took on the case of a girl named Nazanin Fataya in Iran. Young girl who was being raped, stabbed her rapist, and still she was the one sentenced to death. And Nazanin Afsanjan, the Canadian, made a difference all over the world, and she's standing by right now in Vancouver International Airport on her way to Europe. She'll be at the Cambridge Union speaking, and she's a guest of Amnesty International in Berlin. And Nazanin, thanks so much for taking some time to spend with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
Nazanin, where's the case of Nazanin Fataya at right now? We know that due to your efforts, the death sentence had been commuted several months ago, which was the last time you were on. Where does it stand today?
Yes, her death sentence was commuted. However, she's not out of the hot water, so to speak. She's in prison. She's had two heart attacks since because of all the pressure.
Amazing. And this girl is in her teens.
Yes, she's 18 now. She was 17 when the offense happened. And she's awaiting her retrial. Basically, she had a trial on the 30th of August where they were supposed to give her verdict. But they've delayed that once again, and we're waiting on the next date, which will probably be in the next couple months. So we're waiting on the lawyers to give us information.
Mm-hmm. Now tell us about the speaking tour and what you hope to raise and what kind of consciousness you hope to raise in Europe on this.
Well, again, I'm going to be speaking about the case of Nazanin specifically, and also bringing to light the case of other child executions in Iran and in the Middle East, because obviously Nazanin acts as a symbol for a greater problem. And so in Berlin, we're holding a huge event. There's going to be 8 big pictures of children who've been executed last year in Iran, and we're going to encourage the public to cut down postcards of these, you know, pictures of these children, and they're encouraged to send these postcards to the head of judiciary in Iran, Ayatollah Shahroudi, pressuring them not to continue with these executions.
And that's Amnesty International's World Day Against the Death Penalty, which will be at the Potsdamer Platz in Berlin on October the 8th. And that's where you'll be. And of course, it's not just about the death penalty; it's about the horrible penalties meted out to children for stealing bread, and their arms and their limbs are broken under the wheels of trucks.
Oh, definitely. It has to do with a whole range of issues. Women are continually being stoned to death in Iran because of, you know, if they committed adultery, or you know, if you're homosexual, you can be executed as well, death by hanging. So there's a range of issues, and it's really up to the international community to get together and make a difference and write letters of protest, because they really do work.
And you're certainly making the spotlight shine on this issue, and more power to you for doing it. You've written a song called "Someday" that is dedicated to Nazanin, there's a website that I encourage everybody to go to, www.myspace.com/Nazanin Music, where you'll not only hear the songs and see the songs that Nazanin Afsanjan has recorded, but also her schedule of events and that she'll be doing in Europe and pictures of what she's done prior to this trip. What do you have in the cards when you come back? This action is not going to stop. It's going to continue.
Oh, this action will definitely continue. As long as there's women who are left voiceless in the world, there's definitely a place for me. So I hope to be able to help in any way I can, using my platform as a recording artist and my former titles. So you'll be seeing my name a little bit more.
And we hope to be seeing you in Montreal. The details aren't worked out yet, but the Institute is holding a conference later in the month on women and the world of Islam, and we hope to have you here, and we're going
to
try to work all that out.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Your album is coming out, or your album has come out soon.
It hasn't come out probably in the next couple months. Due to this Save Nazanin campaign, I've had to basically put my music career on hold for the last 6 months. But I'm back, and I'm hoping probably in the next couple months my debut album will be out.
Terrific. Nazanin, have a safe trip to Europe. I know you're going to do great over there, and we look forward to talking with you and seeing you when you come back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time. Montreal, we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Last Angry Man, Beryl Wiseman, on the new 940 Montreal.
And we're talking with Senator Consigli Danino about Canada putting its stamp on the world once again under the leadership of this prime minister. Senator, you wanted to make a point about the Dalai Lama before the break.
Yeah, the point I want to make is sometimes Parliament does work. I introduced a motion in the Senate, and my colleague David Sweet introduced a motion in the House of Commons a few months back to recognize his holiness as a man of peace, as one of the preeminent men of justice and value and compassion in the world, with the Canadian honorary Canadian citizenship. Well, we got those two resolutions passed in both houses unanimously. So sometimes it works, and I guess it's nice to see that. And I wanted to leave the message so that instead of being totally negative, you know, and angry, because I think we should be angry with all of the nonsense that we've seen, I wanted to leave your listeners with the at least this one idea, or that this one initiative, where everybody in both houses of Parliament said, you know, this is a man that we should honor and respect. And it's nice to see that, because, as you know, he's been shunned in the past, and I think that the fact that Stephen Harper is our prime minister has a lot to do with that.
Well, it certainly does, and I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that we have men like you who make the term public servant meaningful. And I'm proud to call you a friend, and it's great to have you.
My pleasure.
Condonino, have a good night.
Thank you, Beryl. Keep it up.
Well, from heroism present to heroism past, you know, one of the nice things about doing this show is that when I get something between, you know, I get a bit between my teeth, I get to talk to a community of interest. I get to talk to people that sort of get my anger in control before the blood pressure completely boils. And I don't think there's any but heroes left in this country, or any straight talkers left in this country. But there were two stories out today that just boggled my mind. And I had to talk to our next guest, who's a man of impeccable judgment. But the headlines were unbelievable. The first story was that the Department of National Defense has decided to censor information on a battalion that was called the Devil's Brigade, the first special forces unit composed of Canadians and Americans in World War II that never lost an engagement. This is a legendary outfit. A movie was made about the Devil's Brigade starring William Holden. And at a time when we're trying to inculcate a new Canadian vision, a new Canadian heroism, it's bad enough we never celebrate Canadian mythology. We never celebrate Canadian heroism. Now we can't even have information about something that was from World War II. And the same time, just above this in the National Post, just above that story, came word that the Department of National Defense tells soldiers who were injured in Afghanistan that they would not be eligible for extra pay on their return to Canada. This is a remarkable disconnect between the political message and what the bureaucrats are doing. And just to discuss this for a little while, I just had to get on General Lewis McKenzie, because my mind cannot get my mind around this. General Lewis McKenzie, welcome.
Hi, Beryl.
Lou, I don't know. You know, Do we go to Belize or what?
No, just don't take it seriously. I mean, it was such a joke, the whole thing about the Special Service Force, the Devil's Brigade, not having their sort of locations of their major battles fought, etc. Then you turn to the inside of the Ottawa Citizen, there was a map there showing all the locations, because there's umpteen books out there describing exactly what they did and when they did it. In fact, I owe part of my career to one of the veterans, General Stan Waters. You might remember, the first and only elected senator to sit in.
Sure.
It didn't make it, unfortunately, passed away from cancer, but nevertheless was a lieutenant and a captain that served with the Special Service Force. So some poor, innocent, inverted commas, bureaucrat, you know, even drew the wrong linkage, because in the article...
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, what has this got to do with JTF-2, which is our news?
Absolutely nothing, because JTF-2 is like the Special Forces, the Green Berets. They work in small teams, you know, whether it's 10 or 20 or whatever, whereas the Devil's Brigade was a formed unit, over 1,000 folks. And that relates more to the battalion that is being created wearing khaki berets, a la the British Special Air Service, the SAS, in Petawawa. So the whole thing was like almost like if it was the 1st of April, I would have taken it seriously. You know, it was an April Fool's type of thing. So, you know, no need to take it seriously. It'll be sorted out. The aspect
Lou, mm-hmm. if I could just ask you, we've got to pay some bills, and we're going to talk about some things that do matter today right after the break.
Okay, then.
And we're talking with General Lewis McKenzie, and tonight I am angry. I am angry because we are talking tonight about Canadian heroism, past and present. And sometimes you just get tired of trying to explain to Canadians the necessity of our involvement abroad, the necessity of our involvement with transcendent yearnings for redemptive change, or the necessity of our involvement in democratic development, the necessity of the Afghanistan mission. And perhaps no one else has done more talking on this than Lou McKenzie. Lou, do you ever get tired at all these rallies of trying to make the chattering classes understand the importance of what we're doing there, and are we losing or winning the PR war?
Yeah, I think we're
in Canada. In Canada,
I'm losing the barrel. I did a piece today, which I sent off to the Globe and Mail, which hopefully will pop up in a couple of days, and it was Afghanistan. Ask the right question. We keep asking Canadians, do you support Canadians serving in Afghanistan? And you know, 58% come back saying no. Why not ask the question? Do you support the Taliban taking control of Afghanistan again? And I think probably the response would be the majority would say no. But if you say yes, then obviously you support beheading of teachers,
right,
and, you know, and executing of women, all these things. So there is some responsibility that has to be laid at the feet of the pollsters and the media for focusing on the repatriation ceremonies, the ramp ceremonies, and nobody's over there looking at the accomplishments.
We live in a time, in an era, in a society of instant gratification, where everything is video games and what's the number and what's your score.
Yeah,
but this isn't about seconds. That. This is about helping a country ravaged by destruction build itself up. That message is important, and is part of the problem when we have an Operation Medusa. We let the opposition say, well, we should be in Pakistan taking on the killers that are crossing the border. Yet when we do an operation like Medusa that is tremendously successful, that Canada led, we don't hear enough about it. Is it bad PR on the part of D&D, Department of National Defense?
You can't blame D&D, because they shouldn't be putting out the message. It should be the government of Canada, foreign affairs are the lead, because foreign policy and defense policy, hand in glove, and the glove is foreign policy, and they're the ones that take the lead. And quite frankly, what we're doing over there right now is picking up the shortcomings of a whole whack of other NATO members. NATO has a stake at its heart right now, and when the wash-up is done, when this mission is over, a lot of people aren't going to come out smelling like roses, and NATO itself might not exist anymore, because we have a whole bunch of reputable countries that are sending their troops to Afghanistan with little caveats after their name that says, we don't go out after dark, and I'm not making this up, and we don't do combat. So please send us to the nice, safe area somewhere up north of Kabul where we can do the touchy-feely stuff.
Which would have been fine if the previous government hadn't dithered for so long and the only mission left was Kandahar.
Well, and you know, during the bombing of Kosovo, Serbia, which I very much disagreed with, but nevertheless, a whole bunch of countries, Greece at the head of the list, where their population was totally and absolutely against the bombing campaign, they were there participating because they were members of NATO, and they felt obliged to respond to NATO leadership. That's not the case in Afghanistan. A whole bunch of people just turned around, faced the wall, and said, no, we're not playing. And I mean, so what's the value of NATO if you see a crisis and you can't count on the 29 nations of NATO who have agreed that attack against one is attack against all, and there was attack against America, and they just don't show up to the party?
So you stay with the ones who do, and that
forms
a new alliance.
Yeah, pretty small in numbers. You know, Australians, the Brits, the Dutch, ourselves.
Well, you know, there are two things that struck me that have recently been written. About Afghanistan, about the whole global war on terror. One was something you said that I'll never forget. What said, if the bean counters were in charge of D-Day, we'd never have D-Day. But the second was written by, I think, Douglas Davis in The Spectator in London, when he said, at least today it's not 1938-39. At least today the English-speaking world gets it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter, does it? As long as there's a coalition of the willing, to use an expression that's been used maybe once too often. But it starts somewhere.
Yeah, and I think the most misleading comment, and it's the most common comment you hear from the critics, is, you know, the world's a more dangerous place today than it was just before 9/11. Duh. They're absolutely right. But all I ask people to consider is, what if we had done nothing after 9/11? What if we just sat back and watched Afghanistan continue to produce Al-Qaeda and its imitators, and Sudan, and Indonesia, and all these other countries, didn't interfere with their financing, didn't try to take out their leadership or whatever, we would be, 9/11 would look like a pinprick if we had have taken that attitude. But that's what people, oh, gee, it's more dangerous now. And you've got to insert the really inflammatory word in all of this, Bush. I mean, it's Bush's war. It's not Bush's war.
No, it's not.
It's our war. It's our war against people that want to see our eradication from the face of the earth.
This is like in 1940 that was the Queen's War. But you know what? It's important to keep talking. It's important to keep the message out there. As Albert Camus said, there comes times in human history where merely to be human is to be heroic. And that's what we've got to do to get rid of this.
Once Canada's in the last 15 years is at the head of the line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's gonna burn off the stagnating smog that's cloaked a bodyguard of lies that we've lived under. Lou McKenzie, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Have a good one, Daryl. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye, Daryl.
We'll be back.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you can email your comments to info@iapm.ca after the show. We're going to turn our attention now to another part of the world, Latin and South America, Central and South America. We don't often look there, and yet it's a source of incredible riches. It's a source of incredible trade. Many of you just have to do things like look at your car windows, and you'll see where they're made. And it's a place of incredible political turmoil and it's a political laboratory. And what is most interesting is, of course, recently, just 7 to 10 days ago, we saw Hugo Chavez of Venezuela do his comic number at the United Nations. But just going back 4 years, things were a bit different. Mexico was stable under President Vicente, in quotation stable, under President Vicente Fox, who the former executive with Pepsi-Cola. And Hugo Chavez was not Mr. Wacko yet. And the big fear at the time was Brazil, because Brazil had just elected a charismatic labor leader named Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and they were the prognostications for Brazil were horrible. This guy didn't know money, didn't know economics. Like all socialists, he was going to take Brazil and make it a basket case. And Brazil was being compared disfavorably with Venezuela. Now, 4 years later, Mexico has gone through a really troubled election campaign where the candidate of the Party for the Democratic Revolution, the leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador, claims that the election was stolen. The winner Felipe Calderon of the National Action Party, President Fox's chosen successor. We'll see how that plays out. Venezuela, we see what Hugo Chavez is doing to it. But Brazil, who's just had a first round of elections and they'll go to a second round because nobody won 50%, has actually become quite a bit of a success story. And Brazil is huge. We're talking about almost 200 million people, one of the world's five largest land masses, and we don't pay enough attention to it at all. And we want to welcome Ed Dossman, who's a senior research fellow at York University Center for International Security Studies, and we're going to talk a bit about why Brazil came out okay and what the Venezuela we don't know about. Ed Dossman, welcome. So socialists don't have to run a country into the ground necessarily.
Not at all, not at all, particularly if they're pragmatic.
Which, as he's called Lula, but President Inácio da Silva certainly is that, if nothing else.
Yes, we call him President Lula. Everybody uses that nickname. But the difference, as you described 4 years ago, is that he and his party decided to continue a gradual and successful transition away from military rule, and a transition which has leveraged Brazil into a position of very considerable power and authority today.
Now, he's doing all this, and you've got to explain a little bit more how he's doing all this in a nation that, as by your statistics, have approximately 45 million people out of a population of 185 that are 185 million that are destitute. Where's the power coming from?
The problem of Brazil is that for 20 years it was run by military governments, 1964 to 1985. They got, for a while, very good economic growth. It was called savage capitalism, but they failed to educate the bottom half of the country. So that after 1985, the country is stuck with an incredible dilemma. That is that it has one of the worst income distribution problems in the world, some of the worst slums in the world, a lot of civic violence, a tremendous problem of public education, so that it has a modern Brazil in the south, which is first world, and in the north and in the slums, it's truly a developing country.
Ed Dossman, right after the break, because we've got to pay some bills or we'll be a developing radio network, we're going to... I want to talk about how he's managed to get in control of so many people and contain the verbiage and contain the dogmatic statements that seem to be inherent in other South American regimes. We'll be right back after this with Ed Dossman.
Sure.
And we're taking a look at South America right now with Ed Dossman, senior research fellow at York University Center for International Security Studies, and particularly Brazil. Ed, I'm fascinated to know, here's President Lula, as he's known, and he takes control of a country with great poverty, and he doesn't have to resort to the kind of dogmatic nonsense that Chavez has done in Venezuela, which is seemingly a far richer country, and he's built this tremendous consensus. Is it through force of personality?
It's force and personality, but it's also a national tradition. You have to think of the left as being totally different than every country in South America. There is a rise of the left, but it's completely different from one country to the next. So one really has to start with each country.
Right. So the comparison could be going back to the 60s and 70s, you had Berlinguer communism in Italy, which was sort of Kashmir communism, and you had Georges Marchais in France, who was really a hard-bitten, you know, pull out all the stops, everybody against the wall kind of guy.
Yes, I mean, when you think of Brazil, think of a country like India. These are big regional leaders, powerful countries that really dominate a whole continent, no? And they look at international affairs in a much different way than a small oil economy like Venezuela.
Right.
And in the case of Venezuela, the political system, in effect, collapsed, the worst corruption in Latin America, which is saying something, eh? And so Chavez came in with a radical program, but, you know, shake a hand, count your fingers, okay? Because underneath...
Very good.
Underneath the rhetoric of Chavez is a pretty smart and careful politician. And remember, for all his talk with the U.S., trade between the two countries has grown.
Why?
But it's oil. They need each other.
Okay, it's oil, but Venezuela is not more than 9%. It can be replaced, 9 or 10%.
Well, it's very close. It's an established market, but also the elite of Venezuela is wildly pro-American. And Chavez himself is when it comes to action, not wording, is very pragmatic. He knows that in a showdown with the U.S., guess what's going to happen?
He's going to back down.
Sure. So, in effect, what's happened with the U.S. is that the U.S. has dealt itself out with the war in Iraq and setting up that concentration camp in Cuba at Guantanamo. That really is it. That reminds all Latin Americans of torture, of the CIA. And so as long as the U.S. has relinquished leadership, I mean, in a sense, the U.S. has given up leadership in Latin America. So into this vacuum come people like Chavez. Now, very few people in Latin America, and particularly in Brazil, approve of what Chavez is saying. But the U.S. looks to Brazil to control and manage Chavez, because they can't.
How can Brazil?
It's the dominant country in the region. 185 million people. It's far larger than Venezuela. And every country in Latin America, in South America, realizes that you need Brazil on your side. For example, Venezuela has just joined the South American Common Market, Mercosur.
Right.
That's Brazil's creation. So Brazil has many levers, and it's Lula, really, who plays a moderating role in the region. So look at this as a big, unhappy family in South America, led by Brazil. The quality of Brazilian leadership is very high, and Lula has built on strengths. So, in a word, Venezuela is a divided, polarized society. There's a high degree of cohesion among the leadership, at least, in Brazil. Does that help?
That helps a great deal. The second round of voting, what happens if the opposition candidate, Geraldo Alckmin, wins?
It'll be continuity. There's very little difference between these parties. President Lula, has put a little more money into the poor, but every Brazilian realizes that unless Brazil deals with poverty, education, the cities and the slums, the country will be undermined. So there really is a high degree of consensus. This is not the case in Mexico, but in case in Brazil, Brazil is a much more cohesive country, and Brazilians who speak Portuguese, they're all alone as one country
right.
In South America. They're tremendously proud of Brazil as a culture.
It's a linchpin, and we'll be watching the election carefully. Ed Dossman, thanks for the background.
Not at all. Thank you.
Take care. Have a good night.
Good night.
Well, Montreal, we've been looking around the world tonight, and I want to get back to where we started, which is where Canada's going. And Canada's going where heroes go. And we've got a new vision in this country. And one thing that we have to understand as a people, that Canadians are back. And Canadians have clout. And let's be proud of that. And let's be proud of the men and women that are overseas representing us and participating in those great struggles for redemptive change. Thank you to Nick Mays. We'll be back tomorrow night.